Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, what is your relationship to Native Americans? Do you feel part of that culture? Are you curious about it? What do you honor about yourself in relationship to, let's call it Native Americanism? And to help us understand this journey is a wonderful book that I've read. It's packed with incredible, not only information, but really exciting activities that have happened and awakenings that have happened to the author of this book, Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. So we're going to speak with the author. I'm so happy he's a guest on the show, is Randy Kwiatkowski. Randy, welcome to Energy Stew.
Thank you very much.
So you are Native American, but you
legally,
you might have had hints
legally
of
enrolled tribal member.
Excuse me? Say it again. You're enrolled as a tribal member. Are you hearing me okay?
Correct.
Right.
That's a legal designation used in the United States, and different tribes have different rules. We're allowed in the United States by the federal government to write our own rules. So for some tribes, even some branches of the Potawatomi tribe, they use blood quantum, which is very strict. It's a percentage of ancestral Indian blood. So if your great-great-grandfather's the connection, you wouldn't make the cutoff. In my tribe, it's simply a matter of whether there was continuous enrollment as of a certain date. So as you know, you can tell by looking at me on camera, I don't look like an Indian, so to speak. And one of the difficulties Native Americans have is confronting historical stereotypes, which are very often largely built on Italian actors in the 1950s and 60s playing American Indians in Hollywood movies.
So it's fascinating that you have this history, and it wasn't a big part of your life for a long time. And you talk in your book about how you kind of discovered your roots in ways that it came to you. It was like it was reaching out, your ancestry was reaching out to you to rediscover yourself. And it's fascinating to read about that in your book.
Yeah, I certainly didn't go seeking these connections. If I look back now at my life, I think there were glimmerings occasionally of what I would call Native American sensibilities, but it was only in recent years, last 4 or 5 years, that it has become a daily occurrence and more often a nightly occurrence. And as one of the first illustrations in the book shows, with Alice caught halfway through the looking glass, 1 foot in one world and 1 foot in the other, I now spend much of my life with my consciousness, on the two sides of the looking glass, and each one glaring back at the other, interrogating the other and asking, so which one is real? Which one do you want to go with? It's both exciting and occasionally perplexing.
But I see it's very captivating because you've explored so much of it in recent years and explored who your ancestors were and had really interesting coincidences, serendipity about being in the right place at the right time. For instance, going to a talk at the something to do with the history of the Carlisle Indian School, that a grandfather or great grandfather attended, or grandfather he was, and you have a cousin who was a Native American, Jim Thorpe. I was fascinated by that. But there's so much in your book about how Native Americans have been treated in society over many generations to, in many ways, bring them into our culture, but in ways that destroy their own, and as if it's good for them, because there's so little respect that was given to them from the very beginning, because we were the conquerors and they were in our way, and so there was really lack of respect. Although what's fascinating is that so many people who would, let's say, be captured by them in raids, that they'd be abducted, and when it was time, when they were rescued, they didn't want to be rescued. They actually wanted to remain in the Native American community because they liked it better. In so many cases, our culture has vilified Native Americans historically, and it was really a terrible time. But it didn't stop, and it kind of began with something that you talk about in your book called the Doctrine of Discovery. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes. Well, I'm a historian, so you know, when I first heard about it, you know, I just had to dig. And learn more. And the more I learned, the more horrified I was. And a cousin of mine who teaches Indigenous studies in Canada every year starts her course with this notion. And students, both you know, mainstream white and Native American, both get outraged for different reasons. And they both question whether she's telling them the truth. So essentially what happened is that after, you know, the Spanish monarchs in 1490s, forced the Muslims out of Spain, finally, from the Spanish point of view, they had been there for, you know, centuries. The Pope rewarded them with this declaration called, you know, the Doctrine of Discovery, to translate the Latin. And basically, he told them that he was giving them all of the newly discovered Western Hemisphere, North and South America, with a few exceptions, in gratitude for this act of faith, getting rid of the infidels. And in the Doctrine of Discovery, I mean, if you read it in translation, it's incredible, it's horrifying. Basically says that settlers, the conquerors to come, will have full possession of these said lands, because there are no Christians there, therefore there are no civilized people, therefore, they have no claim to their land, and they have no claim to their possessions. And this was used for centuries to erase any claims that Native Americans had to territory or resources. And when students hear about it, they think, oh, 500 year old, what's the relevance? Well, it's been cited by the US Supreme Court in the 20th century and in recent decades as legal precedent. And it actually was indirectly referred to in this recent famous Gorsuch decision about giving Oklahoma tribes back sovereignty over criminal prosecution on their lands, when the justice with one hand said, oh, you know, Native tribes have absolute sovereignty here, and on the other said, because Congress has not yet decided to revoke it. And then he explained, you know, with three legal precedents, that anytime they wish, the U.S. Congress can unilaterally withdraw and negate treaties made with Native Americans. So it continues this notion that we weren't a morally constituted people who had any legitimate claims to legal holding of land or possessions. It's astounding.
Yes, and there are many people who probably still believe in it anyway. And but it's fascinating how it doesn't have to be conscious. It really is this whole idea that the Native American culture should assimilate itself into our culture, and disappear. And so it's more about that even now than land and possessions, even though that's a huge part of the trouble that Native Americans are having, is that they've been squeezed into land and situations that don't support them. But the whole idea of our culture wanting to assimilate in ways that destroy other cultures, really. I mean, it's fascinating how there are so many immigrants to the United States who have brought with them all of the language and culture, the artifacts, all of the lifestyle of their cultures. And in the early days, I think they wanted to maintain that, but they, you know, much of it is being lost. And even, for instance, and now I'm going back to Native Americans, thinking of the Navajo, which I've done some radio shows about, and they're spread out through the Southwest, and they're starting to lose their language. They have one of the most fascinating languages on the planet, and yet there are fewer and fewer of their young people who are learning to speak it, and there's a fear of it being lost. So there's so much.
This is a great concern.
Yes, yeah, it's really. But then again, let's look at what this means when we bring cultures together. You know, there's this issue about how different should we be and how much the same should we be in order to communicate well and to get along well. We do need to have a mutual language. But I really love older cultures, and I'd love for them to present themselves in their authentic way, in their older ways. So I'm very much against blending to the point of losing identity. And I know that, you know, for you, you're really caught in this beautiful world of ancestors and spirit animals and all these ways that your culture speaks to you.
Well, for generations in my family, you know, we experienced assimilation was the term that was used. And I mean, I'm quoting here the Godfather founding spirit of the residential schools that were used to re-educate young Native Americans, where Jim Thorpe and my grandfather went, you know, both of them went to the
right, the Carlisle Indian School in Kansas.
Carlisle
Indian School. Mm-hmm.
And the literally the motto was kill the Indian in order to save the boy. So, you know, their hair was cut, that, you know, they were literally beaten if they spoke their language, their names were taken away. And it was a pretty brutal, literally, process of stripping away the memory of being an Indian. My grandfather never spoke to us of the experience. He did not bring him to speak of it. And we do not even know if he had a Native American name, because it does not appear in the records there. But what's fascinating for me is, even though there was a break, if you wish, a hiatus in the transfer of the outward culture in my family, as I try to make clear in the book, something lay dormant in mind or consciousness. I don't even know how to conceptualize it. There are so many possibilities. And then, you know, of its own volition, if you wish, it just resurfaced, and in the most powerful way. You know, it wasn't always quiet. Sometimes I think I used the metaphor of, you know, the police coming up the driveway with flashing the lights and breaking down the door. I mean, that's a metaphor, it didn't happen. But it felt like that kind of just, okay, we've waited long enough, Krakowski, wake up, tonight's the night, we're gonna shoot something more. You know, and I would have to sit down and write to elders in the tribe and ask them, am I going crazy, or is this the kind of experience Native Americans have? And I've grown very comfortable with these kinds of awakenings and visitations, and I now embrace them and see them as an enormous gift. And if I read the signs and the messengers that the hawks and the shooting stars and the owls bring me, my ancestors are basically saying, we've been trying, you know, you're doing what we had to give up on, but it's not over. You know, our culture is alive, in diminished numbers perhaps, but it's needed now more than ever. And I feel like the planet is giving me the same kind of, you know, feedback. There's this notion of James Lovelock that it's a living system called Gaia. And sometimes I feel like ancestors and Gaia have teamed up to say, you know, this is the moment for Native Americans to reawaken, not only as a people, but to reawaken the mainstream, because we've been headed for too long in the wrong direction.
Well, it's interesting because I'm thinking that it's really hard to restore Native Americans to any original culture in any thorough way, so much as I think of Native Americans as being our teachers and actually helping us restore this love of this natural life. And they're the role models for it. And to allow them to really be these teachers for us that we need in order to restore our planet.
There's an opportunity there to listen to the traditional knowledge, some of which is scientific, some of which is spiritual wisdom that Native Americans have to offer. The challenge is, as you alluded earlier, Native Americans have been romanticized and recast so many times in a framework of what the mainstream European civilization wanted, that they have to disentangle themselves, and you know, we need to present ourselves in the authentic voice of our heritage. That's not so easy. The danger is putting Native Americans back on a pedestal and seeing our culture and our sensitivities as something unique to Native Americans, but not accessible by the mainstream. And I walk kind of a delicate balance with my feet in both worlds. On the one hand, saying, I think anyone and everyone can appreciate Native American sensibilities. Maybe everyone can't experience to the degree that I have those exact sensibilities, but that doesn't mean that we can't learn from one another. It's a matter of respect and avoiding Yes. this trap of appropriation.
Right, and it's so beautiful that you're saying that. But I want to come, there's so much to talk about with you. Your book is so full of many different areas of interest about this whole subject matter. And I want to look at just about who you are as a Native American and how that is taken in by the world or not. And you use a hybrid animal called the coy wolf to kind of describe what it is to be of two worlds. And you're of two worlds. And so there's a coy, I don't know how you pronounce it, but a coyote that has merged with the wolf and is very active in the Northeast and actually other parts of the country as well, but in a way that isn't as frightening to people as wolves and more capable of surviving than a coyote by itself. So it is integrating two different cultures that actually are helpful. And it also speaks to you as a spirit animal.
For me, it's almost almost a totem at this point in my life. But for the book, I made Quay Wolf a metaphor, because as you so nicely summarized, this is a relatively recent hybridization of coyotes from the Southwest that moved north as wolves were made extinct by white settlers, and they interbred. DNA analysis now indicates exactly when and where it happens in Ontario province in a specific park at the turn of the 20th century. And then over the course of the 20th century, they have moved throughout New England and continued to interbreed, sometimes even with dogs. So, you know, they are the ultimate hybrids or mongrels, if you wish. And when we look at humans and when we look at Native Americans, you know, the story that's told is as we assimilate and as we intermarry, as in my family, we lose our culture and we become weaker. But for me, one night in the middle of the night, when Quay Wolf visited and kept walking around the house and howling, you know, I took it finally as a message of, wake up, Randy. I, Quay Wolf, am here and surviving in the forest in a way more deftly than either wolf or Quay Wolf could, because I can eat the diet of both the wolf and the coyote. I have the jaws and the teeth of both. And I am stronger for being a hybrid. And, you know, it was a moment of enormous insight for me, a message brought by one of our natural kin saying, okay, Randy, so you're not a pure Indian. You're not also, you know, purely European. You're something in between. And if you can blend the best of both cultures, maybe that's what we need to survive on this planet right now. And I think that's the challenge and opportunity of the kind of bridge building effort that I hope my book will be.
Right. And I think one thing to get from that is that there are a lot of people who are saying, to be Native American, you need to be pure blood. You can't be a hybrid of European culture or any other cultures. And that's really what we're trying to attain. But as you're saying, you know, the hybrid cultures really bring a lot more to it. And I think that is something that needs to be honored, that people who aren't fully genetically Native American should honor the parts of them that are, and as you are. And I think that really will create a much larger population of Native Americans. Maybe 10 times the size or more, because so many Native Americans have integrated genetically. And I don't think there needs to be any judgment about that in any negative way. As you say, it's really, it brings a positive blending.
Well, I'm very clear in my book saying that I am writing about the off-reservation Native Americans. That's my experience. I have not spent an enormous amount of time on reservations, and I certainly didn't grow up there. I can't speak to that life, but I'm deeply grateful that there are, you know, sadly small islands, but that they still exist, of our various Native American cultures where people are struggling to maintain the language, the ceremonies, and the knowledge in its purest form, because that helps to inform not only the mainstream, but the people like me who are halfway between the mainstream and the Native culture. So we have this continuum of Native American-ness, and I think there's value in the entire continuum.
Yes, and so it's been wonderful talking with you about this book, and I really heartily recommend everyone to absorb themselves in it, because there's so much that you talk about. You're really quite thorough in looking at many different aspects of life as a Native American in the way that you are. and the way that we need to honor more, as well as what you just talked about, the people who really represent the purest aspects of the culture. And there's so many interesting stories, maybe we can get into them in another time, because you talk about how so much of their society was destroyed by disease, and how we're being faced with those potentials now, and what it means, so we can look at what we might have learned or not learned from the past. And so there's a lot, so many interesting details in your book that would be fascinating to talk about. But I'm so glad that we could talk today and understand how important it is to bring your experience into the public's view and have people read your book. It's called Without Reservation. And your name is Randy Kritkowski. And you have a website that people can go to?
Yes, I made an author website because I realized people would want to know, who is the person behind the book and where did he come from, and just a short biography. So it's randykritkowski.com. It's quite simple.
Oh, good. So that's the place to go, and to buy the book also, either there or probably on, I guess on Amazon as well, or where, other book sellers. So thank you so much for being on Energy Stew. It's really fascinating to talk with you. I'm so happy to.
Well, as we say, miigwech, that's thank you in Potawatomi.
Good, and I appreciate it. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.